It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Ebola epidemic and the economic and political ramifications for West Africa, especially Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, the countries most affected by this crisis. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In an address at the UN high-level meeting on Ebola last week, U.S. President Barack Obama underscored the seriousness of the Ebola outbreak by characterizing the epidemic and the slow international response to it as a threat to regional and global security.
But this is also more than a health crisis. This is a growing threat to regional and global security. In Liberia, in Guinea, in Sierra Leone, public health systems have collapsed. Economic growth is slowing dramatically. If this epidemic is not stopped, this disease could cause a humanitarian catastrophe across the region. And in an era where regional crises can quickly become global threats, stopping Ebola is in the interest of all of us.
On this edition of Encounter, we will specifically examine not just the humanitarian toll of the disease, but also how it is exposing the deficiency of West Africa's public health infrastructure and its devastating effects on the economies of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. For it is more than the virus alone that is tearing apart affected nations, but rather the fear itself about its rapid spread. This fear has had devastating effects on the stability of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, three countries that were just merely beginning to recover from years of conflict and instability, are now in the midst of experiencing catastrophic blows to their economies. The World Bank estimates GDP losses to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea will be a combined $360 million. International companies have removed workers, key economic projects have been suspended, and manufacturing and construction are being affected. But the greatest economic scare of all has been seen in the agricultural sector. Roughly half the populations of Liberia and Sierra Leone, who work on cocoa and peanut plantations, as well as rice and cassava farms, have abandoned their work in fear of the virus. In addition, many Liberians are dependent on their ability to cross into Côte d'Ivoire to help with the cocoa harvest each year. With closed borders, Liberians are being denied this right, and there could be unfortunate economic losses for Côte d'Ivoire's cocoa industry as well. The World Bank says if cases pop up in surrounding countries, the economic cost could be into the billions of dollars. Well, with us to discuss the economic and political ramifications of the Ebola epidemic on affected countries as well as on the broader African continent is Amadou Sy and Stephen Morris. Amadou Sy is Senior Fellow of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank here in Washington. Amadou also currently serves as a member of the Editorial Board of Global Credit Review. Also joining us is Stephen Morrison. He's Senior Vice President and Director for the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a think tank also based here in Washington. And Stephen previously served in the Clinton administration and also taught for 12 years at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And both gentlemen join us today by phone from their respective studios. Amadou Sy, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also Stephen Morrison, welcome.
Thank you, Carol.
And let me begin with you, Stephen. Let me get your reaction first to what has been characterized as the West's failure to act more aggressively to contain the Ebola epidemic from the very beginning. How did we let this get so out of proportion to the point now where it is considered not just a regional but a global threat to security and economic stability?
Well, I think several things happened. First of all, the spread from a single country, it began in Guinea, spread rapidly into two neighboring countries and then migrated in that course into two coastal and now three coastal urban centers. We hadn't seen that before. This was happening in a population that was naive. The public health systems in those countries had very, very weak surveillance and laboratory capacities. so that the first outbreak in Guinea, which we believe was in December, was not confirmed and reported until March 22nd of this year. So it was a very long lag time. Then WHO and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, came in with teams in the April timeframe and offered various forms of advice, most of which was ignored. And there was a sense then that things might be going back to a more steady state, when in fact what was happening was the epidemic was being driven underground. You had significant mobility of populations across borders. You had significant distrust and fear of governments. And so people that were getting infected, were getting sick, were not coming to health facilities. They were moving the other direction. And so it became a bit of a shadow epidemic. As it became visible in the June timeframe, Doctors Without Borders issued the alarm bell. That didn't register very strongly with the rest of the world. WHO, another very important dimension of this, is the World Health Organization, which is really mandated to be a lead agency in detection and response, had severe budget and staffing cuts in the last 3 years. So it was very incapacitated in this period. So you had bad governance of the countries themselves, terribly weak health infrastructure. You had an epidemic driven underground by a population that didn't trust folks, and you had a very weak WHO. So that by the end of the summer, as this thing really rocketed off, people were caught off guard. They were shocked to see the scale of this. We'd never seen anything quite like this.
Indeed. Turning to you, Amadou Sy, anything to add or subtract to that excellent summary provided by Stephen Morrison with respect to how we got to this point?
Oh, no, this is a very clear expose of how we got to this point. And I think that a key point there is this distrust of government is something that we take for granted in some countries, but in the region, it proved to be a big problem.
Absolutely, and we're going to get more into that later in the program. But back to you, Stephen Morrison. How do you characterize the U.S. strategy that was laid out recently by President Obama to help contain the outbreak, particularly, of course, in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, where the U.S. military is, in fact, in the process of building hospitals, hundreds of beds, health facilities to treat more victims? How do you see this as making a significant difference?
Well, first of all, the president's announcement last week, deploying 3,000 troops, creating an air bridge into the region, building 17 hospitals with 100 beds each, adding 1,700 beds to Liberia, which today has slightly more than 500 beds operational, training up 500 health workers per week, establishing a new training center to do that, distributing 400,000 kits that are meant to be home care kits for those who have persons in the home that are infected and symptomatic. All of these measures that were taken, along with seeking to work much more collaboratively in getting others to come forward and cooperate within this response. This was a major mobilization. This was a surge commitment by the United States government. It was essential. It was a response to an awareness that, first of all, the epidemic was on a full-blown trajectory. It was on an exponential growth. That means that every 20 days, roughly, the numbers infected and the number of fatalities are doubling. That means in those three-week periods, every person who is infected and symptomatic is infecting one to two other persons. And then at the end of that cycle, those people are infecting another one to two. So you do the math. It was exponential. As you pointed out earlier, you had the collapse of transport. You had borders going up. You had the swift exit of NGO talent, of folks in the commercial sector. You had the commercial sector collapsing. We were staring at an abyss. There had to be some sort of military-style operation launched in coordination with civilian agencies and NGOs that could crack the security gap that was coming forward and create an environment in which you could begin to deploy thousands of new health workers into this setting in a safe way. What is the goal here? The goal is to change the epidemic so that it's not on an exponential path but is brought down slowly under control. In order to do that, you need to separate them, you need to isolate them, and interrupt the chain of transmission. That's the only way to bring this under control. It is not going to be easy. It is not going to be simple. It's full of lots of risks. But the United States government moved forward with over $1 billion of reprogrammed Department of Defense resources on top of several hundred million dollars of civilian agency expenditures. USAID already has a disaster response team with lots of CDC folks on the ground in the region. There are over 130 CDC employees on the ground, another 30 to 40 USAID folks. And the UN also, under Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, is moving to establish a what's called UNMIR, a UN mission for the response to Ebola that will be an operational center within the region. So there's going to be a multilateralization of the response effort. How all of these parts fit together over time is all to be determined.
Indeed. Turning to you, Amadou Sy, with respect to what Stephen Morrison said, we were staring into an abyss. We needed a major push, which the United States obviously has provided, and let's see, remains to be seen to see to what extent this and the so-called multilateralization of the effort can be properly coordinated. How do you see things from the ground? I know you're definitely have your finger on the pulse of the local response, whether political leaders, a failure on their part. What about the response on the ground? Are you seeing stepped up coordination and also at the local level in terms of the victims and potential victims? Are you seeing change in attitude to help prevent the spread of the virus?
When you look at the counterpart of this humanitarian toll, it is really like the economic problems it is creating. So restrictions in the movement of people and goods are hurting trade, are hurting transport, and those are just what the official trade statistics can capture. But, you know, there's a lot of informal trade going on in this region, as in many other African regions. So if you include the informal trade, you know, the impact is even much larger. Then, of course, we have agriculture. We are going to go into the harvest season in October, December for rice and maize. And, you know, with restrictions again of movement of people, we could be looking at some problems when it comes to food security. And again, the United Nations is looking at it carefully with the FAO. But when people cannot move and people do not harvest, we have a problem. In mining investment, again, we've mentioned the restrictions, the repatriation of personnel by the multinationals. But again, I insist on this informal sector because, let's say, take Sierra Leone, where you have the exploitation of alluvial diamonds, right? So again, if people cannot go next to the rivers, we have a problem. But coming to the government now, the government will, and the World Bank and the IMF are working on it, but the government is really in a difficult situation because on the one hand, fiscal revenues are falling down because of the slower economic activity, loss of revenues in taxes, tariffs, customs duties, and some etc. And at the same time, expenditure to solve this crisis and meet the higher health and security needs are rising. And again, let's not forget that the impact on the poorest necessitates also more transfers, more money. Let's take the women, for example. There's definitely a fiscal problem here coming up. And the World Bank estimates the short-term fiscal impact can be, you know, as large as 93 million in Liberia. It's about almost 5% of GDP. That's a huge number. So here, really, we're looking at countries where we had a nice growth trajectory. Sierra Leone was expected to grow at 14%, Liberia at 10%. And suddenly, the lack of appropriate public health infrastructure is proving to be tragic.
I want to get into that after the break. Mm-hmm. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Amadou Sy, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution. And Stephen Morrison. He's senior vice president and director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about the catastrophic Ebola epidemic and its effects on the political and economic stability of West Africa. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or keep up with me on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Muhammad Abid Rafi from Pakistan. Thanks for your comment, Muhammad. And if you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with comments and feedback to encounter@voanews.com or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Stephen Morrison. Again, we go back to, of course, the very weak health infrastructure in these countries in particular, and probably in all of the continent. For the short term, we need to get this epidemic under control, and perhaps looking at the long-term viability of the health infrastructure now seems perhaps not as important, but I think we need to address that. How do you see, whether it's the West or other countries, richer countries on the continent, whether Nigeria or Angola, these oil-rich countries, seeing this as a wake-up call to fortify and strengthen the just public health infrastructure so that this kind of epidemic can be prevented in the future?
I do think what's most important is to emphasize that these three countries were standouts in terms of how acutely weak their health infrastructure was. If you look at what happened in Nigeria, for instance, in Nigeria, which has struggled with polio in the north and done quite well in the last couple of years, when you had the introduction of Ebola into Lagos, Patrick Sawyer, the Liberian-American diplomat who got sick, exposed to his sister, flew to Lagos, went into a hospital, died. He was actually on his way back to the United States, to the Midwest. The mobilization that happened there was quite impressive. You had a good portion of the polio team out of Abuja deployed to Lagos. You had CDC folks come in. You had 40 to 50 Nigerian experts mobilized. You had over 1,000 contacts traced effectively. There was still spillage into Port Harcourt, but you had some strong basic infrastructure. You had good partnerships. You had an emergency operations center in Abuja focused on polio that turned its attention to the Ebola outbreak and was quite effective. And that story tells a different story than what we've seen in Guinea and Liberia and Sierra Leone, where you had no capacity of that kind. In Senegal, you've had a much better and more effective containment strategy there as well, reflective of the fact that their health systems are functioning better. The reaction, I think it's been the isolation that the region feels because people are cutting their air links, because they're closing their borders, they're closing their entry into seaports and the like. I think there's been a certain measure of alienation within the region among these three principal states towards the way that they've been isolated by the rest of the continent. There's great fear, there's great trepidation.
Well-founded, I suppose.
Yes, and on the more positive side, whereas this region has been emptying of talent and people, and it's been closed off and isolated, and its air links have collapsed, and its economy is in regression, you have had some promising initiatives undertaken. Uganda has dispatched, for instance, 25 experts in Ebola control. Uganda has had major outbreaks, had the largest single outbreak in Gulu in 2000 prior to this. So it has considerable experience and expertise in running emergency operation centers, in doing surveillance and confirmation, in doing isolation campaigns, doing contact tracing, and changing burial practices. The critical things that need to happen to break the chain of transmission. They've dispatched 25 people to West Africa, and I think that's very laudable. The Ugandans have done that through WHO. The African Union has, for the first time, through its peace and security arm, it has organized a mission that is a public health mission to leverage the expertise within the continent to come in to be quite helpful. I think on the longer-term reconstruction efforts, the most important players are going to be the World Bank. The World Bank is already under Jim Kim. Jim Kim has come in very strongly in support of both the emergency response, $105 million in emergency cash going to be disbursed last week, and another $125 million on top of that for long-term reconstruction of the health infrastructure, and has made clear that the bank is going to stand by emergency facilities like Amadou was talking about. As the state fiscal revenues decline because they're not collecting duties, they're not collecting taxes, economic trade and activity is declining, there's going to be a need for infusions of stabilization funding to keep things ticking over while these countries are on a path to recovery so that basic functions of government do not seize up. And some of that will be in the health sector as well. The bank is coming forward. I think the question that will be on the table at all of the deliberations at the UN General Assembly this week, at the Global Health Security Agenda meetings on Friday, the 26th, held in Washington, D.C., called together by President Obama. At all of these deliberations, one of the major themes is, what is the long-term strategy? What is the strategy for recovery, for putting in place systems that will be durable, sustainable, that will be feasible? Because everyone recognizes that when you have no capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to these emerging outbreaks, you're exceedingly vulnerable. When you take three countries with highly mobile populations across them, and none of them have these capacities, you're throwing a lit match into a conflagration, which is what has happened here.
Indeed. Back to you, Amadou Sy. Certainly this long-term strategy is critical. But for the short term, many of the damaging consequences are occurring to the economies and, of course, the social fabric of these countries. So my question to you is, besides the World Bank, which is going to play a critical role, the United States and WHO, besides perhaps Uganda, what other countries do you see putting up support from Africa? And again, I have to insist on the oil-rich countries of like Nigeria, Angola. Really, do they feel a sense of responsibility to their neighbors or ECOWAS? To what extent do you know of any monetary contributions from these countries? Or what about the oil-rich Arab countries? Are they putting money on the table to help these other coordinating organizations get the job done, both in the short and the long term?
So regionally, you have ECOWAS, of course, with Nigeria having the natural leadership given its economic size. And you have also Ghana, which is in the region, which can play an important role. So far, as Steve said, the United Nations Mission on Ebola Emergency Response, UNMEER, will have 100 people or so in Accra, and they will also have Center for the Training of Personnel. But so far, I haven't really heard much from like ECOWAS or the Western African Monetary Union, which is the union of the Francophone countries with the CFA franc. Actually, the president of Guinea was complaining about the closure of the border with Senegal. Senegal closed its border. So I think going forward, as is the case for the war against terrorism and so on, we need really to strengthen regional capacity in Africa. You know, regional integration has to be taken more seriously, I think. And health security aspect of regional integration has to be taken, you know, we have to do a better job than what we're doing right now.
Well, back to you, Stephen Morrison. As we conclude, for example, on the local level, are you seeing or do you anticipate the sealing of the borders that has occurred, particularly among the three countries? Do you think over time, particularly as we ramp up with these emergency measures, that that will be relaxed, the cessation of some flights? Because, of course, these are all having devastating economic impacts on these countries.
I think, Carol, this all depends on whether there's a success at breaking the chain of transmission. Mm-hmm. As long as this outbreak is on an exponential growth path, it's scaring the living daylights out of everyone. And you can't recruit personnel to come in and staff the programs. It's very hard to persuade folks to relax the border closings, to restore air flights and the like. So there needs to be some dramatic proof that the chain of transmission is being interrupted and that some of these interventions are beginning to take effect. What we're going to see is action happening on two tracks. One is the higher end treatment and care, as the 17 hospitals in Liberia are created. There's plans underway for all sorts of NGOs to be putting additional hospitals up, and those are meant to answer the immediate requirements. Right now, those facilities are swamped. There was a hospital with 150 beds opened up in Liberia. First day on the job, they were swamped, and we need to get beyond that point. So that's one track, is the isolation and treatment units at the higher end, where you can get infusions, you can get antibiotics, you can get rehydration care to improve your possibilities of survival if you become infected. The other track is to try to address at a local level within communities and households across the country, as well as in the urban settings, to address the reality that you have a lot of people sick with Ebola that are living in one-room homes, that are intermixing with their families. How do you break transmission in that context? We're on unproven ground, but there's a big push here. I think this makes a lot of sense to try to move ahead across these countries in creating isolation techniques that won't be picture perfect, but which someone becomes infected and is either in a single space within a home or is moved into a isolation ward within the village, and there's a single designated person within the family who cares for that person and is provided with protective gear, provided with some basic medicines to alleviate suffering and be able to clean up and preserve some measure of protection and hygiene so that the transmission rates are cut and so that the person who is suffering, that suffering is ameliorated to a significant degree. These are the two paths, the low-tech and the high-tech, the local and the facility-based, that are going to be moving ahead, and they are going to be the front edge of this great experiment on whether or not this exponential growth can be broken.
And the last word to you, Amadou Sy, if you want to address even the local response, we know that there is already probably stigmatization among victims who have survived the Ebola virus. People perhaps want to stay away from them. There are orphans of people who have died. Those are the long-term consequences of this. And then, of course, the impact on the political regimes, both in Sierra Leone and Liberia. Do you see changes in the offing with regard to better communications, you know, at the local level, so people understand how to break the transmission, changes in burial practices that are much safer to break this terrible cycle?
I think really what is striking to me is that the major risk factor here is the fear of contagion factor. Then it makes it so important to really have the correct facts, to have good communication strategy at all levels in the cities, in the villages, the training of people at the community level. And so I think communication really here and trying to really break the perception and not get into an overestimation of the risk factor is really key. And I think to some extent, some of these countries have in the recent past been able to overcome very, very difficult situation, you know, with the civil strife and you remember the killings and so on. So I think that there must be some infrastructure that has been inherited in the fact that they have been able to solve those problems, you know, civil war, that can be used also to communicate and train and educate people.
Well, gentlemen, we will be following this story and discussing the epidemic and hopefully its containment in the weeks to come. I want to thank you both. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Amadou Sy, Senior Fellow of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and Stephen Morrison. He's Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you, gentlemen, for your terrific insights on this important issue.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Keith Holmes, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.